Hello and welcome to the Future Virtual Economies podcast. This podcast is a series of informative chats about recent developments in the world of virtual economies in and around video games. Today we will look at a paper our group has written recently, which is under consideration at a journal, a paper on worldwide mobile gameplay. How does the world play mobile games? Have our assumptions about mobile gameplay in different countries been correct? I'm Catherine Flick, a researcher at De Montfort University, where I work with ethics in games, as well as the ethical implications of new technologies, most recently blockchain technologies such as cryptocurrencies and NFTs. With me today is David Zendel, a researcher at the University of York and the most published author worldwide on in-game monetization systems. He's advising governments worldwide on regulating the games market and working hard to provide data and facts to guide regulation so we avoid policymakers enacting new policies without having a good basis for making decisions. He is also the first academic to dive into the world of crypto gaming. We also have Sebastian Dieterding from Imperial College, one of the most prolific and cited academics worldwide on game design and user experience, with a track record of helping companies develop responsible and sustainable designs in games and beyond. He is also an expert in gamification and design engineering and a renowned educator. And finally, Anders Drachen from the University of Southern Denmark, the world's most published author worldwide on game data science. He has worked across academia and the games industry for 20 years and is quite old by now, according to him. He also has the dubious honor of being very popular with sharks who have tried to eat him across two continents. Yes, well, as an Australian, I can appreciate that as well. What a team. So, as mentioned, we'll be talking about our new paper on mobile gameplay. So first up, David, what was the motivation behind this paper?
So I think there are a number of myths that we all just kind of commonly accept about how different people from different countries tend to play games. And I think these narratives often center around splitting the world in half. So you say you have most of the world, which is normative, and they play games in a normal way. You know, a regular proportion of the population plays games. They play games for a normal period of time every day. And there's sort of like a kind of a predictable distribution in which some people play more than others. So you have that part of the world, and then you have a different part of the world, which we often, in the literature, kind of describe as being different or exceptional or strange in some way. And this typically revolves around Asian countries, where you say you have these issues with Asian countries where people tend to play games very heavily, in a very heavily engaged manner, where you have this very hardcore elite sort of emerging from the distribution of players who really do spend an extraordinarily long time playing games, and that this phenomenon is pan-Asian in many ways and exceptional. The really interesting thing about this description of global gaming patterns is that it's not really been tested with data, right? So we have this myth of Asian exceptionalism, but whether that myth is grounded in reality is unclear. So what we kind of wanted to do with this paper, I think, was say, okay, Unity Technologies have given us access to this massive global data set of playtime, which for the first time lets us actually see how people from different countries tend to play games and if different countries tend to play games differently. If we look at that data in a unbiased way and just see what patterns emerge from it, do these patterns of exceptionalism emerge in the way that we've been sort of theorizing they might do for many decades? And I think one thing that we found was that some countries in Asia seem to have patterns that fit this idea, but not all of them by any stretch. And also, whilst we were looking at the data, we found the emergence of lots of different global gaming cultures that people hadn't theoretically touched on before.
That's really exciting. So I think we'll come to the findings in a bit. We'll leave that little bit of a suspense murder mystery thing going on here. So just wanted to know a little bit more about the data concern. Obviously, this sounds like quite an impressive set of findings that we can have out of data. Anders, can you tell us a little bit more about the collaboration with Unity and how that helped with answering these problems?
So what Unity has done is quite exceptional in the games industry in that they have actually shared the large scale behavioral telemetry data with academia. Now obviously all of this data is anonymized and all the research that we're doing here is in accordance with GDPR, just to alleviate any concerns that our audience might have, but we have As a game analyst in academia, I previously worked with at most looking at sort of aggregate level playtime from a couple of thousand games from Steam. The kinds of data that Unity is collecting as the world's preeminent game engine provider are sort of thousandfolds larger. So we are right now we are studying data from millions of game titles from hundreds of countries and areas, and across several years. Now this scale of data, this scale of information about a almost what's called ubiquitous, what's the word? Like a common human activity is something that we just haven't had access to before. And this data set means that we can look at both the global scale, but also very, very accurate levels, like individual cities, in a way that we simply haven't been able to study gaming behavior previously. And this is completely upending everything that I've been doing for the past 20 years. I'm now looking at all my old research, looking at a small sample players from World of Warcraft, or a couple of hundred thousand players from here, or even, sometimes when we've been able to look at three different games at the same time, and I'm looking at it going, yeah, that's not terribly useful anymore now that we have access to these enormous, highly detailed data. And frankly, I think to me and to everyone here, it signifies a complete shift in how academia and the industry, how we collaborate. I have to give Unity credit for taking this bold new step.
So, David, that sounds like a lot of exciting things that could come out of that amount of data. What were some of the highlights of the paper in terms of the results we found?
I think for me, one of the most interesting things we saw was the presence of patterns that had been predicted by prior work, but in places where we didn't before think we would see them. So you have this idea that there are some countries in East Asia in which people tend to play video games very heavily, where there tends to be a very strong culture of hardcore gaming in which there's a lot of playtime equality and a lot of playtime concentrated in a very, very small proportion of the population. And we do see that. So we have a cluster which we call the Dugong cluster. We name each of these clusters after sort of animals that are typical of a specific geographical region. And that cluster is made up of kind of like these wealthy East Asian territories with typically high GDP, high average standard of living. So the countries here are Singapore, South Korea, Macau, and Hong Kong. And these are typified by high average play per day. So if you're playing games in these territories, you're playing quite a lot. High duration per capita, so gaming tends to be quite widespread in these countries. And like a really, really, really strong metric of playtime equality. So a lot of playtime is concentrated within a very few people. This is totally consonant with the idea of uniquely hardcore East Asian gaming cultures. But interestingly, these cultures are concentrated within a small number of countries. And if you look at other countries where you'd, and in fact, where previous academic work has anticipated a similar type of gaming existing, for instance, Japan, you don't see it there. And in fact, the way that Japan clusters as a country groups it together with North America rather than with these East Asian nations.
Yeah, that's super exciting. I mean, I think for me it was very much about how the Chinese market works, right? So everyone expects China to be to play in a particular way because they have, a particular socioeconomic background, they have political systems that are quite different from the rest of the world, et cetera. But actually, in our findings, we find that they play very similarly to Europe, which has completely almost the opposite in terms of you know, social, economic, political background from China, and I, for me, that was absolutely fascinating, because you'd expect Europe to be closer to the North America, and you'd expect China to perhaps maybe be either on its own or maybe clustered with some, you know, some of these East Asian countries, perhaps in certain ways. But actually, the fact that China and the UK play mobile games very similarly is just astonishing to me.
Yeah. And I mean, and it is worth highlighting here again the scale of the data set that that we are operating with. I mean, this sort of first very, very limited study is based on 118 billion hours of playtime and data from about 2.1 billion players. This is, you know, many orders of magnitude larger than any previous work in this space. Back in 16, I was part of a project where we looked at about 3,000 games on Steam, very, very aggregate level playtime data, and we were fascinated because we were dealing with actually 5 billion hours of playtime. We didn't have any geographical data at all. We were just looking at what are the aggregate playtimes for four different games, right? This is 118 billion hours, and it's just 1 year's worth of data. The limitation that we have is that obviously we're only looking at data from Unity games. So for example, we cannot say something about various esports titles like Counter Strike and Dota, which are made with different engines, and they might have different patterns. That being said, we are still looking at a ridiculously large amount of telemetry data, something that we don't talk about in the paper, but an analysis that we haven't published yet is looking at which games that are the most popular where, and what kind of geographical or temporal patterns that exist in popularity. And there, it's also very interesting seeing that the games that are very popular in China and other parts of Asia and in Western Europe, they might be different, but again, as you mentioned, Catherine, the way that we play them is extremely similar, and this is a pattern that we've never been able to really document this, and it sort of goes a little bit counter to the idea that there is a big difference in how we play games in between the East and West, especially for mobile titles. But what we're also showing is that the overall market, like the geographical distribution of playtime, is extremely fragmented. There are some overall clusters or groups of countries that play games in similar ways or share a lot of the most popular games, but the deeper that you go, the more fragmented the overall image also becomes, showing there are market differences even within the same country. And interestingly enough, this mimics many patterns in nature. For example, in terms of climates and microclimates, where the more granular that you get, the higher the diversity you also see. And I think this is particularly interesting how human patterns in gameplay globally, they sort of mimic how, for example, climates are generated in coral reefs from sort of the large global scale and down to an individual coral bommy.
Yeah, and I think also what's quite fascinating is the kind of also the fact that we can look at like countries that normally aren't looked at within the gaming literature. So things like South America and African nations and you know, the Indian subcontinent and those sorts of spaces.
Yeah, exactly.
The fact that there's some really interesting kind of, like, for example, we find that India and large amounts of Africa, both North Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa, play similarly, which is quite impressive given that India's population is very large and, you know, kind of upwardly mobile compared with some of these other countries. And it's just like, and then parts of the Middle East play similarly to sort of Saharan area, Africa. And then we get, you know, Brazil and some of the larger South American countries looking very much like some of the Central Asian countries, which is quite interesting as well. So I mean, obviously some of this comes down to sort of GDP sort of similarities and kind of economic and social similarities perhaps. But I mean, the disparity in terms of the geographical space and that is just really quite exciting, I think, as well.
Yeah.
Do you have any other further insights from
I guess, like, I just echo what you're saying. I remember when we were looking through the data and we were seeing the cluster structure emerge and we were like, wow, some of these things are things that I've never even heard anyone vaguely even start to talk about. So, like, do you remember when we started looking, so when you're doing this clustering, it's kind of a process of knowledge discovery. You don't go in with predefined ideas of what groups you're going to find. You look at the data and then you see these groups emerge. And like, exactly, yeah. We ended up with this thing called the octopus cluster. So again, we thought long and hard about how to name each of these clusters, and then we eventually ended up with these animals that kind of live in roughly the area that the cluster exists in. And like, octopus territories are like they're typically Pacific Island states, right? And within, so you've got like these chains of tiny island nations, and within these places you haven't got many people playing mobile games, but the people who are playing mobile games play more per day than in any other part of the world. This isn't a group that's been even thought about before, like, or described before. So one of the really exciting things about being able to take like a gigantic data set of billions of hours of play and see what emerges is that you are not guided by biases. And I found that very exciting. And I hope that like kind of future work digs into these unique novel groupings and tries to unpick like what are the drivers of that clustering existing? Why are there this group of countries where people are playing in a certain way that's distinct from the rest of the world?
And if you're living on a beautiful tropical island, why are you playing mobile games? You got coconut
you're
palms
on the beach.
Yeah,
but
yeah, man.
Yeah, I guess I get that. I guess if you're living on in
you
these places,
you
get used to it, right? But I
don't know. If
I guess for them, any beach, yeah, whatever. It's the same old beach, right? But still,
I remember Catherine at the time was like, "It's holidaymakers, right?" Like, I don't know if that ended up in the paper or in the discussion or not, but we were like, what could explain this? Is it like beach resorts? Is it beach resorts where people go on holiday and they're not going to work, so they are just chilling out and playing a load of, like, match three games or whatever? But it'd be really interesting to dig into that.
There's some other interesting ones like that. So, for example, we found some of the areas where there are like outposts for military, like American military outposts, tend to have higher rates of play as well, and little things like that where you're like, you know, we can't say that that's what causes this, right? Because we have no actual understanding of the drivers behind this, but some of these things sort of make a little bit of sense if you think about who's actually there, who might be playing mobile games, and things like holiday makers perhaps, or in countries which have high kind of economic disparity, there might be a certain group of people that play a lot of games who don't have much else to do, sort of thing, right? So it's an interesting it's really going to be really interesting to see what future work,
right? Because you could think you could do like a, so like the really unique thing about this Unity data is it's all anonymized, so you have no idea who these people are, but you have really unique data on what's going on. So you could, if you wanted to, you could do a whole paper about gaming on holiday, right? So you could find the people who go from one country to another country and then see how their play changes after travel, particularly if you have boomerang people who go somewhere and then come back. That would be, like, it just opens the door to a much more granular understanding of how play fits into human life. And that's super exciting.
Yeah. So, Sebastian, would you like to come in on this? What are your reflections on this paper and some of the things we've been discussing?
Sure. I mean, I come in on this as literally a reviewer too, right? So I haven't been involved in actually writing it up, and I found it a super interesting read. I think kind of three bits for me. The first one is just to positively highlight the great fact about this data set, that it is mobile gaming. It's not desktop and PC. So, and thereby, I think it sort of recenters the debate on the thing that we don't necessarily talk about in quote unquote the games industry, where everything still seems to be very PC and desktop centric, even if, right, global spending and global playtime, etc., has shifted to mobile. So the fact that you're centering mobile here, I find very positive. The other thing is, again, that it recenters us from, so right, in anthropology or social sciences, we speak about weird, right, Western educated, industrialized, rich, democratic, as the kinds of countries that are like us, where the researchers come from, and that's what we always talk about. And this data set is, no, let's look at the total world. And then you said, suddenly Pacific Islands pop into the map. South America appears differentiated and matters. So you're recentering us from, let's talk about Europe, North America, Australia, so what's been called the global north, and then in addition, Southeast Asia as the big new growth market, towards taking the total work into account. So that in totality is the great thing about this data set, and the great thing about literally talking about the global actual variety across all kinds of cultures and nation and circumstances. So my kudos to that. My second feedback is, as a qualitative researcher, I always go, that's a nice data pattern you have there. Would be a shame if it went unexplained. So where's the thick data to make sense out of this big data?
Yeah, exactly.
Right? So what are the underlying explanations for why we see these clusterings that you see? And so the one thing that I would just like to have a bit of feedback or comment or thought about it. So if I look across the clusters in terms of playtime inequality and hours of playtime per capita, two of your stats, and I really hope readers have a look at the beautiful graphs and the beautiful numbers on the side, I still find that you have sort of two big clusters which more map onto my common sense understanding. So that's your reindeer and your bison, and then also your dugong cluster. So which are basically the global north plus China and high income Southeast Asia. And so I wonder to what extent is something like just GDP per capita, or something like the emergence of a global middle class or a global high income class, right? So a relatively large number of total players in your country that have a lot of disposable income and that have disposable leisure time. Once you see that emerging for economic reasons, you see gamers appear. So that's where you get your player inequality. You have suddenly a cohort in the population that actually can afford and has the time to spend a lot of time playing video games. And that wasn't just the case. So I was just waiting on comments. Can you explain these different clusters by a simpler factor than if you get a significant raw number of people in your population that can afford digital gaming in terms of lifetime and money, then you get these clusters. Then you get high player inequality because you get gamers as a phenomenon.
David, any ideas?
Yeah, so like this is one of the... So one of the big challenges of large-scale observational data like this is that cause and effect become really almost impossible to unpick. So I think, so definitely what you're talking about, there's a lot of plausible explanations in what you're discussing here, right? So I think almost certainly, so take an example of like a low GDP African nation. Like this will almost certainly fall into a cluster where we have like kind of low playtime per capita. Maybe people who are playing slightly more. But this could be explained, that pattern in and of itself could be explained by socioeconomic features of the country itself, right? So maybe this is a country in which wealth is unequal, in which a smaller proportion of the population is able to afford the constant data usage that many modern games demand. A smaller proportion of the population is able to afford the massive amounts of leisure time that many modern games demand. So when we see these patterns, they're inextricable from their socioeconomic context. And it's very hard to understand if it's something in, say, a national character that is something unique in a national character that is driving different playtime patterns, or if they are simply a consequence of the resources available to people within a territory. I think that's where the utility of this work actually ends and the utility of other work begins. So I don't think this paper can provide any answers as to why particular clusters exist in particular countries. It can't say, people tend to play heavily in South Korea because of this historical thing that happened and this political thing that happened and that ended up with a huge proportion of playtime clustered within a tiny number of people. All it can do is describe the patterns that exist. And then I think it's the role of other methodologies and other methodologists to try and unpick the different plausible reasons for why these things might be happening and suggest which are most believable or most trustworthy out of the various different explanations. And it might be that some of these patterns are explained through very, very boring underpinning mechanisms, or it might be that they're explained by much more sophisticated and interesting mechanisms. I think when you start to claim causality from a big data set like this, you start to run into problems.
Yeah.
And that's why I totally find it generative, right? So once I look at this differently colored map and I see, there is a kind of orangey cluster here, which is pretty much Africa in the Sahara. Is this just, I don't know, smartphone access? Or is that, as you said, just how expensive is a minute of mobile phone use for these games that all require continued online access? It might literally be just that, right? We know, for instance, that in the United States, a lot of the reason why texting was so humongously popular and messenger apps were not was just different ways in which telephone provider charged you for data versus text messages, right? It can be simple explanations like that.
Yeah, and I think we did, so we, in the discussion for this paper, we looked into some of the possibilities, right? Because this is something that really, as a sort of also a qualitative researcher primarily, that this is what interested me. And this is where I actually started going in and saying, look, what features of these countries might actually be a plausible explanation? Obviously, it's just speculation, given, you know, as David said. But this is where, you know, things like the Caribbean nations that are included within the US and similar nations might be explained by holidaymakers, for example. So, I mean, obviously, you know, America on holiday is different from America at home going to work every day. So it may not be that that's the explanation for it. But I mean, there are some really interesting, like I looked at things like even religio-cultural factors in the Pacific Islands, for example, to see if there's anything that tied all these Pacific Islands together. But, you know, they have different, different kind of economic structures. So like some Vietnam and Guinea are agricultural nations within that cluster, whereas the Pacific Islands tend to rely on sort of fishing and tourism mostly. So, I mean, they're quite different in terms of what might bring people, what sort of leisure times might people have who work there. I mean, for me, it's like a big, it's almost like opening Pandora's box to see kind of, you know, like, well, not in a bad way, though, a good Pandora's box, right? And like, what can we find inside now that we've sort of, you know, just suggested that this could be, that there could be these similarities?
Jumping in there as kind of my final reviewer to comment on this is, so you highlighted this fascinating fact that you have this reindeer cluster, which is basically Europe and then China and some Middle Eastern nations that also fall into that. And you say, isn't that funny that China seems to sort of cluster with Europe rather than Europe clustering with North America, as we would usually expect. So, right. Also, one possible explanation is always that you say, well, there are different circumstances that lead to the same surface patterns. So there isn't an underlying shared causality that produces it. It's just that they cluster similarly, even though the underlying, again, causal mechanisms are different. So this leads me to my comment, which is, what about in your data set history effects? So you collect this data, you say, if I read it correctly, it's October 2020 to October 2021. So this is in the middle of the pandemic with changing regulations that impact people's playtime all across the globe. And also importantly, if we look at China, right, we know that China has regulated gaming, particularly gaming for minors, much more strictly than European or most other countries in the world really have. And they introduced new regulations smack in the middle of your data collection period in August 2021, where they sharpened playtime regulations. So it's just an open question. So to what extent do you think the picture that you see here might be impacted somewhat by history effects of global changes, particular changes in particular nations? So how generalizable are these patterns outside of the time window that you look at?
Anders, you got anything to
say? I mean, that's exactly what we have to start looking at now. This first paper is a very first top-down investigation of a sample of the data that Unity have collected. Now we have to start diving into like what do we see in the detail. If we look at this on a month by month basis or a day by day basis, what do we find different, right? And the temporal dimension opens up a whole other whole other venue of investigation that we haven't really looked at yet. I think it's safe to say that we will be working with Unity on analyzing this data for the next many years. We barely started.
Yeah, I mean, that's totally the convenient position of reviewer too, right?
Yeah.
You can always ask for more data or point out quibbles.
Exactly.
Relative to something where you say, right, we have billions of playtime hours across all of the world.
Yeah, but what about time? Exactly. But you know, all research has to start somewhere, right? And with this, we have opened up a new front in our investigations of games and in games research in general. We can now start doing stuff at a scale that was previously thought unimaginable, right? And I think this is what is exciting here.
Any final thoughts, David?
No, I just really like, so Sebastian's kind of like saying he's big reviewer too. And like, we're just typically a critical position. But I think one of the, it's a really good question. I think the really exciting thing about the having access to a data set like this is that typically what happens with a reviewer two position is that you're going through peer review and someone asks a question which they know is deliberately thorny that you can't answer. Mostly to ensure that that limitation is covered within your discussion. Sometimes just to screw with you, but I think mostly to make sure that your paper adequately represents the limitations of the data that you're working with. And I think something we try and do in the write-up here is say, like, look, this data is limited in a number of ways. And that's a really interesting thing, though, because when you mention one of these things and you have access to the granularity and scale of data that Unity is providing us with here, we can actually then follow up and investigate it. So I think a really fascinating question and an unanswered question is, okay, in the middle of this year, China brings in unprecedented regulation when it comes to how different groups play games. And more specifically, young people become suddenly very limited in the amount of weekly play they can engage in. If you look at the different player profiles going into that regulation, so maybe some people who play every day, but for a tiny bit, maybe some people who play huge sessions once or twice a week, and then you see the barrier of the regulation and how the market changes as it goes through it, you can understand how that regulation actually changes things, which both feeds back into the validity of the conclusions we have here and also further generates knowledge about how human activity and playtime interact, in this case, political activity. And I think that would be a hugely valuable thing to do in the imminent future, to be honest.
So you're telling me China is going to come knock on the doors of Unity and say, we would like to A-B test regulations. Can we have your data?
And that's the danger, right? Fortunately, so like this, possibly all this bit gets cut out. But like the thing that makes this appeal to me is that when I was reading Unity did like a big report on like the games market and stuff. And within that, they had some analysis of the impact of Chinese regulation. And that's a public report, which shows this is something they're already like, A, something that they're invested in, B, something that they don't mind people talking about publicly. So whether or not that's actually true, I guess is something for us to take up with Unity. But it suggests, I find the ability of this data set to talk about regulation really powerful. Because like you're saying, Sebastian, like one of the unique dimensions here is time. And time can, policy decisions affect a territory in a uniquely sledgehammery way at a specific period in time. So you can look for policy impact in the data.
Great. Well, on that note, we're running out of time, and this has been absolutely fascinating. And once again, I'm so excited to be part of this project because it's like mind-blowingly awesome, the amount of data and the amount of possibilities that can come out of it. And I mean, I think we've come up with about 3 more paper ideas just in this podcast, so we should probably get onto those, hey? To our listeners, thank you so much for listening in today. We hope it was enjoyable. We hope it was informative. We'll come back to you with more little podcast snapshots of our future papers, obviously, as well, where we hopefully start digging into some of these more thorny questions. And yeah, we'd just like to finish on that. All the best from us to you.